This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. An exhibition of many works of Toulouse-Lautrec has just opened at the Cranard Art Museum at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It runs through August 5th at the museum, which is located on Peabody Drive in Champaign. The exhibition highlights Lautrec's powers as a graphic artist. The catalog for the show states the posters and prints included allow us a glimpse of the artist's energies at their peak. And the posters and prints, says the catalog, describe Lautrec as brilliant, witty, and acerbic. The co-authors of the catalog are my guests this afternoon. They are Giselle Atterbury and Professor Marcel Franciscono. Giselle is the exhibition's curator. She's the education and research coordinator at the Cranard Art Museum. Marcel is a professor of art history at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join the conversation. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Welcome. Welcome back to Giselle, and welcome, Marcel.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. The pieces in the exhibition are from the museum's collection, correct?
That's right. With very few exceptions, they are in the collection of the Cranard Art Museum, and it's just a tremendously wonderful collection, wonderfully unified, and with so many of people's favorite Toulouse-Lautrec posters.
Yeah. Is this the first time they've been featured in an exhibition at the museum?
This is the first time they've really been put into context. I can remember them being up through the years, as you must,
they
too.
They were, in fact, up last year.
Yeah.
Not the drawings, but the prints were. But they were simply shown as without fanfare as part of the ordinary collection. This is the first time, as Giselle says, mm-hmm. that they have really gotten the kind of publicity that they really deserve, I think.
Yeah. Well, tell us how you organized the show.
Well, it was just a wonderful opportunity to put things together and to realize that that the prints themselves would be gorgeous, those by Lautrec, but that we had so many of his contemporaries that could be shown along with those prints and really enrich what we had. And the opportunity for educational programming hadn't really been exploited before. And there's so many wonderful issues that revolve around Lautrec himself and, of course, that time period, Paris in the 1890s, that we thought, well, we just couldn't miss with this. It was very deserving of, the works were very deserving of a showing, and these issues should be addressed.
Yeah. You mentioned that there are some other works on paper by contemporaries of Lautrec's. Who's included in the show, and why did you want to put those pieces in?
Well, I really do think they set Lautrec into context. And for example, the Manet print that we have of the cats hadn't been shown in any time within recent memory. Mm-hmm. And that helps to reinforce the notion that the influence of Japanese prints was very, very widespread. Again, choosing so many of these others, Ferran and Rothenstein, was to show that certainly Lautrec was incredibly innovative, but it was a wonderfully innovative time period, and a time period where people were being spurred on by just such a wide variety of sources and information, great influences going into French art at that point in time.
Yeah, where do we see the Japanese influence in Lautrec's work?
Well, I think there's many ways. It absolutely permeates Lautrec's work technically and even in terms of subject mm-hmm, matter, don't mm-hmm, you think? Mm-hmm.
In the flatness, in the kinds of colors he uses, in the rhythmical outlines of the figures, in the simplifications of form, in all these ways, he and virtually everybody in that period was looking at the Japanese print.
Absolutely. And then in subject matter, I mean, I think it reinforced mm-hmm. or bolstered his decision to show so many performers and the nightlife.
Mm-hmm. Right, because in Japanese prints, there are so many theater. There
right.
are many
yes.
actors.
Theater.
And,
right,
yeah, right. Right, shown. Well, tell us about this man. when and where was he born? Give us some, you know, give us a little background so that we can have a little context in terms of who he was and when he lived.
Well, Toulouse-Lautrec was born in 1864, is the date that comes to my mind right off the top of my head. And that puts him a generation younger than Monet, for example. And he died in 1901, obviously still a very young person and normally would be at the height of his creative powers. But unfortunately, his health began to deteriorate pretty rapidly in the last couple of years of his life. He was born into an aristocratic family in the south of France, but his family moved to Paris when he was quite young, just school age. He grew up in privilege, and yet he did need to make money as an adult. There's many details of his life that I think are legend, wouldn't you say? I mean, maybe a bit enhanced.
Well, I think it's still not clear. He had a physical deformity. He had a congenital problem with his bones and had fractured both his legs by the time he was a teenager, one after the other within a year, I think, of each other. And the result was that he never grew to his full stature. I'm not sure if anybody yet knows for sure what the cause of this was or what sort of illness he had. But
his parents were first cousins, and this congenital problem ran through the family otherwise. You know, a very, very sad thing. But basically what he grew to was an adult male's torso on a basically a child's legs.
Mm-hmm. And this is always given as the, rightly or wrongly, as the one of the reasons why he preferred to mingle with the nightlife of Montmartre rather than participate in proper higher society, which he could have done, given his birth and rank.
Sure, right.
So when did he begin to study art?
In the early 1880s in Paris, still quite young. And, of course, that was a time period. The Impressionist shows had been going on for some period of time, but it was still a time of real ferment in Paris within artistic circles. And battle lines were drawn. And he pretty quickly said no thanks to the more academic and staid side of things and crossed over.
Mm-hmm. What was Montmartre like when Lautrec was living and working there?
It was still something of a village. I think it had only recently been incorporated into Paris itself. Living was cheap there, and it very rapidly became, because of it, the economic conditions, it very rapidly became a gathering place for young artists. This was accompanied by an accumulation of night spots. I don't know what other word to use for them. Cafes, cabarets, music halls. And the combination of the artists and the nightlife very quickly gave Montmartre a reputation for both seediness and slight disreputability, which I might add was played up very strongly in the guidebooks of the time. I mean, this was a place to visit if you wanted to go slumming.
Right, right. Well, it's a somewhat parallel to Soho in its early heyday.
Yeah.
Just a bit. But I suppose some of the raucousness of Montmartre exceeded that of Soho back in the late 60s or early 70s.
Yeah,
Soho never had nightclubs of that sort of...
No,
like the French
music that was more the east side of Lower East Side.
Yeah.
So if you can sort of think of Soho and then the Lower East Side of New York, maybe as a unit, some of that comes together.
Well, when people hear Lautrec's name, of course, they think Moulin Rouge, right?
Yes.
And there are a couple of photographs in the exhibition of this place, and it must have been quite the deal.
I was amazed when I started reading about it. I mean, it sounded like a Disneyland for adults. It sounded like Vegas or something. They really were audacious in the sorts of things. There was a petting zoo. Women could ride little donkeys around. This huge beer garden dominated by a papier-mâché and wooden elephant. I mean, it was huge.
You don't see this in the work of the artists very much.
No.
You have to read about it to discover how elaborate this place was as an entertainment place.
Yeah. Different rooms and different decor, different exotic decor in different rooms as you would move through the interior.
Because of Lautrec's posters, his art, you know, when you think of the Moulin Rouge, you think of dancers. Mm-hmm. But there was so much more going on.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And that's why I was making the tourist guidebooks. I mean, you wouldn't feel complete in your trip to Paris unless you saw this place. Amazing.
But I dare say the dancers were the chief attraction. The can-can, or I don't know, some books call this dance the shahut. Whatever it was a rather raucous affair where petticoats were freely shown. And this is clearly what drew a lot of spectators.
Right, right.
Oh, very interesting. In addition to his graphic work, he was a painter.
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm. What were the subjects of his paintings? The same kinds of subjects?
Similar subjects, yes. But and, of course, unfortunately, we don't have any of his paintings to show. But, yes, similar subjects. But I think formally they're treated in a much more conservative sort of way than in his posters.
Yes.
Generally, the abstraction that he pursued in his graphic works was much more daring than what he pursued in his paintings.
Yeah, the simplest way to describe the difference perhaps would be the paintings are more atmospheric and they have a deeper sense of space, spatial illusion.
Conventional spatial illusion.
Conventional spatial illusion.
Yeah, yes. That's interesting. The quality of his paintings, are they good?
Oh, I love his paintings, sure.
Yes, of course, like every artist, some are better than others.
But sure, right.
Yeah. But yes, they are very good. Yeah. And they're very similar subjects, too, I might add. The same entertainers, dancers, singers, portraits of his friends, brothel scenes, things of that sort.
Trying to really revitalize the portrait and what it could mean. I think, like his friend Vincent van Gogh, he realized that the portrait image was of a moment and then would last for so many years beyond. And really trying to modernize that old standard. But anyone who'd be curious about his paintings, I think At the Moulin Rouge is wonderful, and it's at the Art Institute.
Yes,
so.
Yes. He's an interesting artist in another way, too, because in some ways he's a transitional figure between the realists who precede him, Degas, for instance, who was really a very strong influence on his work, and the artists of his own generation who in some ways were much more subjective and abstract in their way of working.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, he straddles those two tendencies.
Yeah. In some of the posters, people are cropped. You know, part of them is in the picture and part of them is gone. It's not there. A woman in the upper left hand of this.
The Jardin de Paris poster.
Right, and Yvette Guibert, you can't see her head.
This one here.
Yvonne Chapinet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there are others where people are cropped out. Just there's sort of a line just goes right through them and they're off the page.
That was something he got from the Impressionists and primarily from Degas, who had also done that kind of thing frequently. And the general effect is to seemingly expand the space so that the picture becomes a kind of snapshot of a space which goes much further on all sides. And so psychologically it enlarges the thing by doing that.
I think there's also something very witty about doing it as he does, as you mentioned in this one poster where the woman loses her head.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's kind of brutally funny.
Yeah.
Tough, funny.
One of the reasons may be that that figure who was recognizable as the great singer Yvette Guilbert was not actually performing at the Divan Japonais, the locale of the poster, when he made this. It was a kind of homage to her, but on the other hand, by cutting off her head, he didn't have to, so to speak, lie that she was there when she wasn't.
Right, right. You could tell it was her by the long black gloves. It was like Michael Jackson in one glove. For her, it was two long black gloves. And the gloved one she was, yes. Yeah.
Because, you know, it was very interesting hearing that this goes back a little bit to the Impressionists because, you know, thinking of this compositionally, modern, contemporary advertising does this too.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Think of it more as something of our
That's
age.
That's part of the amazing thing about Lautrec to me is that he was in his middle 20s when he began making these posters. And he seems to have digested already basic courses in advertising and visual ploys. He's so smart right off the bat in terms of how to capture people's attention, how to use lettering, just to grab attention right away with the formal conventions that he uses.
Yeah. What was Lautrec's view of the subjects of his work? How did he feel about these actors and actresses and dancers and prostitutes? And there's a photographer that was his friend who seduced women who came to his studio.
Yeah, yeah.
If one only knew the answer to that. He shows them mercilessly. I mean, the if you compare the portraits of his figures, the entertainers and so on, to their photographs, you can see how cruelly he has treated them. And yet, from all accounts, he was friends with them all.
Yeah.
Including the dancer Jeanne Avril, who was a close friend of his, evidently. But he didn't treat her much better than he treated anybody else in his pictures.
She's really much more lovely than mm-hmm. he shows her. She was charming and young, and he makes her figures more harsh and sharp.
And he does that with virtually everybody he knows.
Right.
Men
right.
and women.
Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
And it's not really clear why, I think.
No, I think Aristide Bruant does all right.
He does all right. He does all
but
right,
otherwise,
yes.
it's pretty tough stuff.
Yeah. Yes.
There's a piece in the book, lithograph of something that was done for a sheet music cover, mm-hmm. The Little Errand Girl. Can you tell us the story of this piece of this, the story that is told in the song? And it's very
interesting.
This was
an interesting piece to research. Little errand girls at that point in time wouldn't make enough over a week to go have lunch at the Moulin Rouge. I mean, when you start looking at turn-of-the-century Paris and some of the economic disparities, it's very shocking. And so many of the little errand girls would turn to prostitution in order simply to survive. And she is being seduced by an older gentleman in the song lyrics. And Lautrec shows the man and the woman, she's hurrying off in another direction. And the song lyrics lament her very, very poor situation and a society that, let's see, how is that phrased? Not my own writing, I'm quoting someone else here, Gail Murray, but a society that would rather see her young, die young than dishonored by meeting this man. And again, to us today, I think you look at the image and you just see a woman kind of headed in one direction and a man looking
right.
over his shoulder at her. But there's a urinal in the background which might have served as a place for them to meet. And that's one of the interesting things about putting the show together is that these images now today seem a bit softened. And yet, when you put them into context, I mean, they were hard, difficult subjects and really spoke of incredibly difficult times for many people.
Yeah. And the figure of the man here, he's the one that looks so corrupt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
This illustration.
Yeah. I think in the song sheet covers, you see Lautrec being, as far as our collection goes, his most adventurous in terms of abstraction and simplification and even brutality toward the figures.
Yeah. What were his politics?
Good question. Everybody wants to know the answer to that.
From all accounts, he was apolitical. He had good friends among those of the left and apparently friends among those of the right as well. And he was a close friend of the avant-garde publisher Tade Nathanson, who was Jewish, and yet he apparently had an acquaintanceship and didn't scruple to work for a pot-boiling novelist of the time who was anti-Semitic. Now, nobody's ever quite figured out what Lautrec's politics were, if he had any at all.
Yeah, there's lots of hints dropped in there, as Marcel said, both for the left and the right.
Mm-hmm.
But, political imagery certainly is rare in his work. We have one piece about Carnot being ill, who was president of the French Republic at the time, and his administration was charged with scandal. But other things, I think, by Lautrec, not in our collection, merely hint at political situations at the time.
One of the interesting prints in the collection is called Babylon of Germany.
Right.
That's pretty interesting. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Well, our print is a keystone. And so it doesn't have the lettering on it yet, and it doesn't have the full color. But the print, it's interesting and extremely rare because of that, because normally the keystone would be printed on again. But for some reason, a very few of these were pulled aside and saved in this this early state. But that was one of Victor Jouve's novels. He was this potboiler novelist, as Marcel has characterized it. And it's a sort of satire on morals in Berlin at the time. And the French hatred of Germans was running very high, to speak in general terms. I mean, the repercussions of the Franco-Prussian War were still very much there. And so you have an image of a sentry who looks like the Kaiser staring at this horse, and he's looking right at the hindquarters of the horse. And then a couple walking down the street, and the man charges on, and the woman looks over her shoulder, at this very handsome soldier on top of the horse. And so everybody's interests are wandering elsewhere. But it's a fun image, and it nearly was the publication of it was nearly stopped. The German ambassador had liked neither the novel or Lautrec's print, but Lautrec managed to make sure that print went out, that poster went out.
So it's so interesting reading the catalog.
Oh,
you guys
good.
Did a great job.
Oh well, thanks.
Thank you.
It was fun to write.
Yeah. You mentioned the Keystone. I think we should talk about how these
were made.
Yeah.
Well, lithography as a process was not quite 100 years old at that point in time. And many things you see all around us in this room are reproduced by photomechanical lithographic processes. But
offset, essentially.
Offset, mm-hmm. But at Lautrec's time, in moving into the 1890s, as his fellow's in his mid-20s, the idea of a large color poster is just becoming possible through the lithographic process. Now, if you go back to the mid-19th century, Currier and Ives is probably something most people can relate to. Those are color lithographic prints. But the large color poster was really just becoming feasible at this point in time. And some of that has to do with the presses and empowering the presses with steam and power pistons and all that kind of thing. But I've made lithographs before as a student, and it's very close to drawing. It doesn't seem as, contrived as etching or something.
Just for your listeners, if they don't know it, in the 19th century, lithography was made by drawing on a very finely smooth stone. The stone was then prepared with acids in a certain way so that when the drawing was washed off, the areas where the drawing was originally would take ink and the rest of the stone would shed the ink. The stone was then inked and run through a press. And So as Giselle says, you could draw essentially on the stone the way you could draw on a piece of paper. It didn't require the very elaborate kind of technical work that something like an etching or an engraving would require.
And the stone, once the image is there, you can make multiple images without deteriorating the image. As with an etching, gradually the line quality is going to diminish.
It all works on the idea
of oil and water repelling one another, and it's a planographic process, so it's all happening right there basically at the same level on the stone. There is a little bit of acid biting in, but it really matters to nothing. It's all at the same level.
And how many posters would have been printed?
Oh, thousands for some of these,
yeah,
yes.
Really? Mm-hmm.
And the stories are that they were ripped down nearly as soon as they were put up because people realized that these were just very exciting. And then they were also displayed in fine art exhibitions in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. So he, during his lifetime, was able to enjoy that knowledge that he was crossing over fine art and commercial art boundaries. You know, we think of Warhol in the 1960s
exactly.
as doing that, but Lautrec was doing it many decades earlier.
And you couldn't imagine a greater contrast between a poster being shown in a fine art exhibition and the way they were displayed in the cities, where you had billboards where they'd be mounted five and six up, one on top of the other, and side by side, packed against each other, so that the thing called... You needed somebody with Lautrec's brilliance as a designer to make them stand out from the pack of posters.
Absolutely. And I really think that's where his genius is just to realize how to grab people's imagination with a visual image.
Also, what you've just talked about, it seems to me that this is a very small-d democratic kind of art.
It is, right. Because, and I mean, that was the hope for many years with prints, in the art world, because you can really go on and on and on with an edition, making many. And take a fine art print and circulate it to a large number of people. And that tradition continued on for a long time. In the 1930s, of course, a wonderful democratic time. You know, the people like Thomas Hart Benton and Grant Wood made prints, and they were circulated at very inexpensive prices, hoping to bring art to the people.
That's all relative. I mean, workers would not have bought these to begin with unless they tore them off the billboards.
Right. And the same hope has been echoed for photography, too. And it hasn't ever really happened.
But well, I remember in college, posters were, that was, you know, that's what you could afford to put on the wall in your room and in your apartment. And there were some talented poster makers where I went to school, and their posters likewise would also disappear.
You know? Well, that's, you know, that's an interesting point that you bring up, is just the whole idea of collecting posters and how exciting all of that's become. I can't say I know much about it at all, but I mean, people collecting rock posters from, you know, the Jefferson Airplane and so forth, and all of that poster history is just a fascinating thing in and of itself.
Well, that really begins, that kind of collecting really begins in the 90s. And in fact, it becomes so popular that there are whole magazines and journals devoted to poster collecting exclusively. So,
I love when one turns up on Antiques Roadshow. You know, it's just fascinating.
Well, this is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about an exhibition of work by the artist Toulouse-Lautrec, which has just opened at the Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It will run through August 5th. At the museum. Our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, the co-authors of the catalog for the show, Professor Marcel Francescono and Giselle Atterbury. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The size of some of these is pretty interesting. I wonder if that, given the size, if that was a real challenge to print these pieces. And
oh, certainly, because you have to register them just so. And there were mistakes, of course, that were made, and there was still quite a bit of waste, but it ended up being a process that still proved more economical, even when working large. And again, there was just, I think Paris was growing so rapidly, there was such competition for these various entertainments, and the whole idea that bigger is better. Mm. But the Moulin Rouge poster is just surprising, because it's his first lithograph, it's his first poster.
It's also his biggest poster.
Right.
By far. And there it required three stones, as you can see
right,
by the...
Right, the. But Charest worked large. And we have a wonderful Charest poster in the exhibition. And he was pretty much at the top of things right before Lautrec comes.
Charest really was the father of the artistic poster. He developed the poster as an artistic medium before almost anybody else did. And was a considerable influence on Lautrec and other poster makers later.
And then a Bonnard poster that we have is wonderful. Not particularly large, but it's, you know, some wonderful comparisons about what's going on. Yeah, we have several Bonnards, but the French Champagne I was thinking about is really a nice contrast to the Charest. So, that was one thing in terms of thinking about hanging the show that was really very interesting, was thinking of this wide variety of sizes of work that we had.
Some very small things. And some,
Well, of course, the song sheet covers are small, and the theater programs are small.
And the pieces that were done for these journals or magazines.
Right, they're not particularly large,
next to the pieces in the exhibition, there's a little description for example, brush, spatter, crayon.
Right. Those techniques.
For someone going to see the exhibition and seeing that description there, how do you, as a viewer, you know, look at the piece and then say, well, the the crayon is here. I mean, the brush is obvious, but you know, where is the crayon and where is this spatter? And
well, sometimes a crayon line and a brush line are going to look pretty similar, I think. Now, my experience in making lithographs is extremely limited. I went through a program where art historians learned to make things. We did things hand on, and I would, you know, mostly spreading lithographic inks. I think I was using probably a beat up old piece of cardboard or something like that. But of course, you can use a brush. And then the spatter, we probably saw the spatter effect in there. Mm-hmm. And I've read that there's still some unsolved things with regard to how Lautrec got some of his spatter effects. He was apparently inviting soap bubbles into the whole process. And I don't mean to gross people out too much, but if you think of dishwater when you're washing dishes, mm-hmm. and what happens to oil and water and soap, and then think of some of that scum drying on a sheet of paper and the variation of effect that you would get. So there's some nicely experimentative things that he was doing. And again, when you start thinking, of course, he was working usually with one of two master printers that he favored working with, but just making these prints must have been very physically taxing for him. He was apparently either 4'10", 4'11", and working on these very large stones must have been very demanding.
Yeah. As far as spatter is concerned, one common way of doing it, whether he did that, I don't know, but one common way is simply to run your finger across a loaded brush and have the material spatter onto the paper, mm-hmm. or you can rub a brush through a screen of some sort and get a fine spatter that way.
Yeah. Also, it's interesting that the colors can be so bold and, in some pieces, so subtle.
Right. Mm-hmm. It, wonderful colorist. Yeah.
He very typically contrasts subtle colors against very bold colors. So he blocks out the main design in very bold colors and then puts in nuances within those patterns to take close-up looking.
Yeah. That's why we took a chance with some of the wall colors in the exhibition, is that we really wanted to emphasize his daring in use of color.
Yeah, the blue, orange, what other colors?
Green.
Really green?
Yeah, wonderful green.
Very interesting. Do you have a favorite?
I do. How about you, Marcia?
Yes, I do, too.
Well, what's your favorite?
Oh, I think I like the Divan Japonais the best, that poster.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, out of all the works in the show, I think the cover for the first L'Estampe Originale is my favorite, where, again, Jeanne Avril is in it, but she's examining a print that's just come off a printing press.
Oh, yes, very interesting.
Yeah,
really
I like
interesting.
That. And, of course, I love the Moulin Rouge, too.
Yeah. And the Divan Japonais, describe that to us. That's
This is the one where Jeanne Avril and one of the a well-known novelist at the time, Édouard Dujardin, are sitting at a bar. Behind them is an orchestra playing, and behind the orchestra is the headless figure of Yvette Guilbert with her long black gloves.
Right, that's the one where we talked about earlier, where mm-hmm. her head is cropped out of the.
Did you have a favorite when you went through the show?
You know what I like? The one on the, when you come in, there are three of
performers.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
okay. I like those. I just so like
that would
those
be
together.
May Milton Coudieu and who is the third?
May Belfort.
May Belfort,
May Belfort.
Of course.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah.
There's a cute little kitty in the May Belfort. In fact, I've been thinking about all the animals that we're lucky to have illustrated by Lautrec in the show. He illustrated many animals throughout his life. He loved animal life and kept pets and so forth and so on. We really have quite a few.
The kitty, as I think you mentioned yourself, is a prop that she was English, May Belfort, and she sang a racy song, which was, I gather, her theme song of sorts, and it involved a kitty in it.
Yeah. Well, for folks who like Brit Common, if you know Mrs. Slocum and her kitty, that's kind of what's going on in that image, and we'll just kind of leave it at that.
That's
if you,
right.
If you see Are You Being Served, you'll know what that little kitty's about.
Also, wasn't there a nightclub at the time?
Oh,
the Black Cat.
Right, right. Well, actually, there's a Black Cat that figures very prominently in Manet's Olympia, and there's a lot written about that image. And the Black Cat was a symbol of, promiscuity, basically. Just
witchcraft, which has always been associated with women.
Yeah, lots of
so generally a kind of seductiveness.
Very interesting. Another thing that we haven't talked about yet, maybe just a little bit we have touched on, is the perspective of his work, which I think is really interesting. Going back to the lithograph of Babylon in Germany.
Right, this, that tilted space, very dramatic.
It's
right?
very Japanese. Ah. And the Impressionists had already been using it. They started using it as early as the 1870s. You can see it in Degas quite regularly. You can see it in the early work of Say Monet from the 1870s. So it had become ingrained already in French modernism by Lautrec's time in the 90s. But it ultimately probably comes from the Japanese.
Yeah, he really picks it up and runs with it, though, because he uses it in such a thoroughgoing sort of way.
Of course, Van Gogh would have used it
before
him. And Van Gogh was clearly an influence on his
and
work.
And I should mention that we do own two prints, that copies of which were also owned by Vincent Van Gogh. So that's a nice little touch in the show. And it helps to reinforce the friendship between those two men and their mutual interests.
Yeah. There is a piece in the show called Confetti. And it's an advertising
for confetti.
The point of view here, or the perspective here, is very interesting as well, where this woman who's being showered with confetti seems to be like she could be floating along with the confetti.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poster.
And before the invention of paper, confetti was apparently plaster.
Right.
With plaster confetti?
Right. I've given a couple lectures on Lautrec and the idea that Brouant sang such degrading songs to his audiences and so forth. And one author says that it was actually a masochistic society. But when you think of plaster confetti, then you just can't doubt it was masochistic society. I mean, who would throw plaster confetti?
I don't know.
Where were the parents? You know, I don't know.
Put that down.
That's right.
They didn't have as much concern for their lungs as we have today,
I guess.
I think.
There you go. There you go. But what an invention. What a great invention. Paper confetti.
Paper confetti.
Son and what a great artist to advertise it. Lautrec.
Yeah. So I wonder how big this plaster confetti was.
I don't know. Big enough to injure someone, and that caused the change in the laws.
They outlawed it.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting thought, too, is just, again, back to French society at the time and changing laws and reading a little bit about how posters were distributed and so forth. Really, there's some similar laws that we have today. You couldn't put them on churches. As much as people probably would have loved to, they couldn't mount these posters up on the sidewalls of churches or whatever. Polling places, very similar laws to what we have today with regard to polling places, and very similar sorts of things happened. What is the law? 30 feet, 30 yards? Mm-hmm. I can't remember, but suddenly you reach that line and you're plastered with signs. Same thing in Paris back at the turn of the century.
Yeah. This next thing I want to talk about here, this lithograph, was done for a program?
A theater program. Lautrec was very involved with avant-garde theater at the time. We're going to have a talk about that at the museum in June by Robert Graves. And I should invite people to phone the museum for very full information about some of the programming. It's 333-1861 is the number for the museum. But yeah, that's a wonderful image that really echoes André Antoine's ideas about acting. You see the actors from the back, and that was very unusual for the time. He pioneered that, Antoine did.
Yeah, that was my question is, you know, you see the backs of these two people, and again we get a sense of motion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, who was painting people's, you know,
backsides? Yeah, right. Exactly. And another interesting thing about this little print, you'll notice the still life in this is very close to the still life in the Queen of Joy image, the poster that advertises the other Victor Joe's novel. So his use of images, he sort of repeats things off and on, not exactly, but it was a way of working that was instituted when he was just a child. And we do have some of these early drawings. And I wasn't able to make the comparison in the show, but in the catalog, one of the early drawings and then a later watercolor obviously coincide, and he's repeating imagery. Mm-hmm. And actually, the image came from one of his teacher's works. So he had this repertoire of images that he could use over and over again.
Who was likely to commission him?
Well, the Nathansons, for example, who commissioned him for the La Revue Blanche poster, were very progressive thinkers.
The entertainers themselves, Jean Avril commissioned three posters from him.
Right.
The owner of the Moulin Rouge commissioned that poster for the
Antoine for the theater programs. Again, a very avant-garde theater director and an actor himself. These music publishers were kind of on the edge of things. You know, they were very avant-garde and leading. So it was people with money, pretty much comfortably set. These performers were pretty much well-known by the time they were commissioning Lautrec, and yet they were people who were certainly not part of mainstream Parisian society.
Yeah. Most of his posters are for entertainments, amusements of one sort or another. That was the life he led. He was a logical artist to commission for that kind of thing. There were posters for more practical kinds of goods and services at the time, but by and large in Europe in the 90s, most posters are for entertainment and cultural events of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm. There must have been fierce competition between these night spots.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, you mentioned mainstream Paris. I wonder what these things look like to the eye of someone who lived the mainstream life in Paris.
He would have been competing in his posters at the time with a number of professional poster artists who had already simplified and flattened and energized their designs. They didn't look like paintings. They were flat. Alphonse Mucha is a very well-known one. There was Jules Chéret, who had already intensified his colors and flattened out his images. Lautrec goes much further in many respects. He's a much more daring artist. But he would have been competing with things that, by and large, already had a kind of decorative patterning to them.
Okay, so it wasn't wild. I mean, it didn't look...
Oh, I think with the hand lettering, he would have looked certainly always a step beyond what was mainstream.
But the main criticism of his work wasn't so much with his designs or his decoration. It was really much more with the content of his work, with this feeling that in some way or other he had shown the most depraved aspects of Paris.
And that, sadly, I mean, that depravity then became linked with his figural being, his stature, and then also he was an alcoholic, and with his behaviors, and all of this starts getting interwoven in the most peculiar sorts of ways, so that when he died, according to some, I mean, it was just as if this depraved, radical, horrible artist had finally gone away or something. And in truth, you know, he actually, especially in the later years of his life, had begun to cultivate these very intellectual sorts of friendships. The nightlife mattered less and less to him. He was respected by mainstream and non-mainstream artists. Mm-hmm. And he was always very close to members of his family. The relationship with his father was always problematical. But, you know, he was not some sort of depraved, crazed, you know, maniac out there making posters. He was a very serious business person. To read his letters is dry. Very serious business person.
How did he do in business then? I mean,
He didn't, of course, need to sell. Well, having come from a fairly well-to-do.
Yeah, he I mean, they were not to make impoverished. Some income, but yeah.
They were not an impoverished aristocracy.
No.
But he did quite well.
Yeah, and he wanted to. Some argue that was to prove to his father that he could succeed, and it was especially through this advertising means that he really could be revolutionary.
Yeah. Is the show going to travel?
There's a strong possibility of that, yes. Very much so,
That would be terrific.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where might it head?
Well, I can't be specific right now, but
okay.
I've personally had some inquiries in the museum. Yeah, there's been some interest. And it should, because it's a wonderfully cohesive body of works, most given by Mr. William Kincaid, who gave the Kincaid Pavilion to the museum. And he had a very discerning eye and a very astute collection of Lautrec works.
And we have, what, about two-thirds of the prints that he produced?
Two-thirds of the posters. Wow. Right. It's very unusual for a university museum to have this.
Yeah. Well, it's a very nice show.
Oh,
and it's
thanks.
The catalog's beautiful.
Thanks.
You so much for coming in and talking with us about Toulouse-Lautrec. And Giselle, give the telephone number for the museum again.
Sure. Area code 217-333-1861.
And the show runs through August 5th.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.